Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, a needle in a hamburger and a court warning. Why South Africa's recovery still hangs in the balance. The real reasons behind South Africa's protest surge. And how hackers are weaponizing crypto in cyber war. It's Wednesday, the 2nd of July. Now, a dinner gone wrong has become a landmark case in South Africa's legal landscape. After biting into a burger and swallowing a needle-like object, a restaurant patron endured emergency surgery, I guess emotional trauma, and eventually some degree of legal vindication. Now, 4 years later, the Western Cape High Court has ruled decisively, if something dangerous ends up on a plate, negligence has got to be presumed. And I imagine this is a stern wake-up call for the hospitality industry. And joining us to discuss the legal ramifications is Justin Malherba, Associate Director at the law firm Weber Wentzel. Justin, welcome. And this ruling obviously drawing serious attention. What, in your view, makes it legally significant beyond the individual case, which happened some years ago?
Yes, this is most certainly quite a shocking set of events that the High Court has dealt with in the Western Cape. It's an interesting judgment and has caught the eye of jurists, not only because of the shocking nature of the events described, but also because the court applied a not frequently invoked legal maxim known as res ipsa loquitur to adjudicate the fault criterion in this case. As we said, this res ipsa loquitur doctrine is infrequently invoked in our case law, and so that in and of itself makes it of interest to lawyers. And essentially, it makes this judgment an interesting study on the laws of evidence in civil proceedings dealing with claims for personal injury.
So what does it say then, using that phrase, which I think translated is the thing speaks for itself? What does it say about the evidentiary burden on businesses now, particularly in the original case where they didn't present direct testimony from key staff, as I understand it?
That's correct. So yes, essentially our law dictates when society requires someone to bear the consequences of harm done to another. And our law of personal injury is, as most people know, fault-based. You either intended the conduct or performed it negligently. The problem is for victims to prove negligence, and sometimes this is a difficult exercise based on partly the unequal access to information that a victim has vis-a-vis a supplier of a good or service. So the doctrine where it is invoked makes this burden slightly easier to bear because it assists victims where, for example, they're not in a position to produce evidence on a particular aspect because it's not peculiarly within their knowledge. It may be within the knowledge of a restaurant owner, for example. So it can be invoked when the occurrence of a harm-causing event is the only known fact from which a conclusion of negligence can be drawn, and that type of incident would not ordinarily occur in the absence of negligent conduct.
Now, my understanding is the restaurant argued that it followed normal food safety standards, but that wasn't enough, was it?
No, it wasn't. And that is a cautionary tale for restaurateurs and others operating in the food service and hospitality industries. Merely claiming adherence to food safety standards is not enough. Where a matter becomes litigious, it will be necessary to produce clear, cogent evidence as to what processes were followed and also speak to those involved. One of the major downfalls in this case, unfortunately, is that the defendant restaurant was unable to produce that evidence and, in fact, didn't lead any witness testimony from eyewitnesses on the evening in question.
So, Justin, before restaurant owners and hospitality practitioners start weeping into their soup, what changes do they now need to make to protect themselves legally and operationally?
Well, interestingly, I think this has been part of the consciousness of the hospitality sector for at least 15 years since the introduction of our flagship consumer protection legislation in South Africa, the Consumer Protection Act. That act introduced statutory protection for consumers of goods and services, especially when it may turn out to be unsafe or defective. So for at least the last 15 years, this has been a major issue for businesses in these consumer-facing sectors. Interestingly, this judgment was all determined with reference to our common law and not invoking the statutory right to claim no-fault liability, which the Consumer Protection Act introduced. Under the Consumer Protection Act, one need not prove fault at all in order to succeed with a claim for product liability, provided certain requirements are met. And of course, there are also statutory defenses afforded to suppliers of those goods and services. So this case shows that the common law still has a role to play and businesses should tread cautiously. Ultimately, many businesses elect to insure against this type of outcome, but it also reaffirms the fact that the hospitality industry has a legal duty to ensure that its products and services are reasonably safe.
And is it fair to ask you how far this judgment stretches? In other words, could a similar reasoning apply to other sectors, maybe retail or healthcare, where physical harm results from hidden risk?
It definitely could, Jeremy. However, the nature of the Latin doctrine is such that it can only be invoked in fact-specific circumstances. So it will in each instance need to be determined on its own facts. This just happens to have been a case that was ripe for the invocation of the doctrine, and it clearly came to the benefit of the victim. But yes, it can apply in a variety of circumstances. It has historically featured in road accident law. It has been a controversial topic in medical and healthcare settings over the years, but most certainly it is in the consumer-facing and product liability arena that its invocation is almost invited.
Justin, I'm assuming that in this particular case, had it happened without the plaintiff preserving the object or even the medical records, there would have been a very different outcome. So what would your advice be to consumers who might experience something similar?
It is always prudent to retain physical evidence as well as documentary evidence relating to an incident such as this, especially where there is an appreciation that this may lead to a dispute. However, the absence of the physical evidence may not have been fatal in this instance because there were eyewitnesses as well as hospital personnel that attended to her in the aftermath, as well as radiological evidence to demonstrate that there in fact was a foreign object introduced through the eating of unsafe food.
And just finally, do you think there is floodgate potential here, maybe a rise in personal injury claims in that particular sector following the judgment?
That has always been a danger in our law, Jeremy, and the courts have been very careful over the years not to open the floodgates of liability by relaxing the ordinary common law position with regards to proving fault. As we said, this Latin doctrine only arises in very circumscribed circumstances. It's essentially part of our law of evidence, and it involves a system of inferential reasoning. So the court in this particular instance had regard to, for example, the nature of the incident, the fact that it was caused by something uniquely under the restaurant's control, and that no further explanation could be offered by the restaurant as to the cause of the accident and the harm that the patient suffered. So there are still sufficient safeguards. The courts usually tread quite conservatively when it comes to developing our common law. And I think this is just a very interesting and recent up-to-date position statement on the law of personal injury.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Justin Malherbe, Associate Director at the law firm Weber Wenzel.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
So how much economic fog lies ahead? Despite a few hopeful signs, the South African economy is still struggling with uncertainty, weak growth, and erratic global signals. And I want to navigate through this very tricky path with Professor Raymond Parsons from the Northwest University Business School. He is a well-known South African economic commentator. So Raymond, a very warm welcome. And maybe let's start with this. Is there a single economic indicator that is worrying you most right now about our current outlook?
Well, hi, Jeremy. I think the overarching factor which really captures the concern of many business people and other decision makers, even within government, is the issue of uncertainty. That certainly externally, we must understand that in the last few months, we've experienced very serious trade shocks from abroad, which has affected the world economy and South Africa. And then, of course, in the earlier part of the year, we had the internal uncertainty when the first budget for South Africa had to be postponed, and that also generated quite a record level of uncertainty in our policy uncertainty index in the first quarter of the year. Now, as you know, from the second quarter, there's been some easing, but nonetheless, although there are positive and negative factors, the bottom line is we are still in very negative territory as far as general policy uncertainty is concerned. And certainly from a global point of view, let's put that to rest now. It is the 9th of July is the next major deadline when we will know from the White House what successful or unsuccessful negotiations will have been now conducted by that still stand period on the US tariffs, and what the impact of those tariffs will then be where no agreement has been reached. And it appears to me that not much agreement has been reached between the White House and certain trading nations.
So, Raymond, in that respect, then, you talk about tariffs, you talk about global volatility. Very bluntly, then, how exposed is this country to a major external shock right now?
I think the important point that we need to understand as a point of departure, we are a small open economy, but that also means that we do have within our control certain policy factors that can help us to create the resilience and the buffers we need to deal with external shocks over which we do not necessarily have control as a small open economy. So the important focus, I think, when we talk about managing the high level of policy uncertainty is to say, what are the factors that we have under our control and where we can do a lot better, given the fact that some of our economic trends are really not favorable and that the negative factors, even in the second quarter, appear to have outweighed some of the positive ones.
So let me push you a little bit on policy. There is conventional wisdom that suggests government is sending mixed signals in that respect. If you agree with that assertion, Raymond, how damaging is this uncertainty for ongoing business confidence?
Well, the uncertainty affects investment mainly, because if you are a business person contemplating a big investment in South Africa, you want to know where you will stand over the next few years, that the rules of the game won't change, and that you have a political stability and you have policy certainty. Now, the big issue here is that this economic recovery that we've been talking about for the past few months is really struggling to get momentum. And we're now only expecting a sort of 1% growth rate this year, which we know is simply not good enough for South Africa. So the two issues that are important internally is that we must get from the government of national unity a degree of political stability, and we need to know that the structural reforms to which it is committed will be urgently implemented, and then also in particular from an investment point of view, and to get the growth going, to implement the infrastructural plans to which we're already committed and for which the funds are available to ensure that we send out a message that the policies and the projects around rapid infrastructural development will take place. And that's an important message for investor confidence.
Raymond, it's interesting to see that the South African Reserve Bank Governor, Lesetša Ganyago, has again reinforced his argument for adopting a lower inflation target. The current goal, he says, is hurting the rand and allows prices to get ever higher. Is he on the right track here?
This is an important debate, and I think the Reserve Bank has quite rightly, after 25 years of inflation targeting and using the 3 to 6% band that we've had for that period, to say, look, we need to take stock of a change situation and we need to aim at a lower rate of inflation because we appear to be an outlier in terms of our inflation targeting band. But that said, I think the important point is not whether you go for a lower rate of inflation, but whether in the uncertain world, both globally and domestically, we can afford to tie ourselves into a fixed lower target. In other words, not a new band or a variation on the 3%, but that you need a fixed target. I think where there are some reservations, there are, yes, we should be looking at a lower rate of inflation, but what form should it take? And this is ultimately, of course, not a decision for the Reserve Bank, but ultimately for the Cabinet, because as the Minister of Finance has indicated, he is receiving these inputs, he's receiving the research from both the Reserve Bank and the Treasury, and a decision will be taken on the exact form in which we would like to aim for a lower and more stable rate of inflation in South Africa.
If there was a shift to a 3% target, what kind of benefits would yield?
Well, what the Reserve Bank is saying, that you will have to accept that in the short term, because you'll have to keep interest rates higher in order to conform with the target, that there would be less growth in the short term, but there would be gains in the longer term. You'd have more stable growth. Now, that's a good economic case. But the fact is, as I've just mentioned, South Africa and the Government of National Unity and the nation at large are grappling with a growth rate of only 1%, and we're trying to get the momentum of this economic recovery going. So I think the timing and the way you set about moving towards a lower target will be an important issue. There are trade-offs, and the important issue is what will those trade-offs be, and how will the Cabinet see those trade-offs in order, if we do want to move to a lower but possibly more flexible inflation target.
And just a quick one, Raymond, in conclusion, is it your belief that South African businesses are doing enough to prepare either for the global disruption that you've outlined to me or the ongoing policy uncertainty that we've been discussing?
I think it's important that the private sector does adjust to what I've said is either the new normal or the new abnormal. And the certainly issue here is that new business strategies will have to be involved to deal with a changing global environment as it affects South Africa. But what is also important is that we get the policy certainty that enables us to say, look, there are large cash balances owned by corporates which have been again confirmed by the Reserve Bank and by another banker this week, that are looking for investment opportunities in South Africa. They want to see the infrastructural product moving so that they can mobilize those cash balances. So the important issue is that we need to manage uncertainty from a national and from a government point of view in order to reduce elevated uncertainty. And at the same time, we need to send the message out that within that environment, we can get the better growth, the better employment, and the better standards of living, and the economic recovery that we ought to see. We really must not be satisfied with 1% growth. That simply is not good enough, and we need to mobilize both government and the private sector to ensure that the GNU's target of a 3% GDP growth rate over the next 2 or 3 years must be realized, and we must take and do the things that are necessary to make that happen in the national interest.
Professor Raymond Parsons, thank you very much indeed from the Northwest University Business School.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Communities from Soweto to Midrand are repeatedly plunged into darkness, literally, often struggling with power outages, damaged infrastructure, and mounting hostility towards technicians. The NGO Right to Protest reports that the route isn't merely load shedding, but rather one of broken promises, vandalism, and maybe most importantly, a collapse of meaningful engagement. I want to discuss that in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Omhle Ntshengila, who is Engagement Officer at Right to Protest. Omhle, thank you very much for joining me. First of all, how would you summarize the current scope of social unrest nationwide? My understanding is something in the region of 27 to 30 protests a day. That's very high.
Yes, it is quite high. As the Right to Protest project, we do a lot of monitoring that indicates that it might be higher actually in South Africa. The number of protests that have been recorded are protests that people give notice to the police or traffic departments or any other presiding officer in the region, and the collective number that they have or any protest that the police responds to, that's the number that's actually there. But what about other protest action that is not recorded by the police or private security that happens often in communities? And that's the feedback we get on our hotline that we run as the Right to Protest Project.
Now, it's interesting to read from your work that many communities first attempt dialogue before embarking on protest. In your experience, then, how successful have these formal engagements been before an actual protest begins, gets underway?
So we've noted that, and we also encourage this with the communities that we work with, that it's good to engage in dialogue before to see what negotiations can happen with the states or any corporates that people have dissent towards in their communities. And this has not been very helpful because a lot of state actors in those communities or political actors shy away from taking accountability when they are held accountable by communities or individuals or activists. Then this then creates a very hostile environment between the state or any corporates in those communities that results in really unfortunate situations. And we've seen that a lot of municipalities don't answer memorandums on time. They don't answer emails or even respond to meeting requests by communities when it comes to service delivery, especially service delivery in areas.
Is there a tipping point, something that shifts dialogue into blockades and violent protests then?
It's exactly that. It's the frustration of not being heard. It's the frustration of being overlooked or ignored by really the states when it comes to communities. It's really, that's just the tipping point. We always advise communities to keep the communication that they send to states. And I can tell you many times, municipal officers and managers just don't respond to communities or literally out just ignore them. And then this then becomes an issue. And we really need all players within, you know, societal ecosystem to assist communities to get a response from governments before things actually go too far.
And then what happens is that the anger, the aggression is turned towards technicians. We've read reports of hostage situations. Mm-hmm. How widespread is this? And it also sends out a very strong signal, doesn't it, about trust in public services.
And this really does happen, especially to technicians from Eskom or any water supply chains from governments, where then they feel that brunt of frustration from community members because they're the only access that they have to governments and keeping governments accountable. As much as we do discourage any sort of violence as the Right to Protest project, we also understand why communities turn to the solution. But we've also seen a success, you know, from community members where with business partners, where community members come to business partners and say, hey, please assist us in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so that situations don't also affect your businesses in communities, and we've seen how business has been so important in facilitating those engagements between the state and citizens to not only just protect citizens from abuse from the state, but to also protect, you know, the community and the progress of how far they've come just to live in harmony with each other.
How do you respond to authorities who argue these protests harm service delivery rather than help it? And I'm just wondering if there are examples where protest has actually led to tangible improvement.
They have. We've seen quite a lot of success when it comes to protests that have really led to water being delivered in communities. This is happening in Limpopo. In the northwest, we've seen how also communities blockading towns have brought more engagements between MEC offices and legislative offices into like smaller villages as well. And even though, as we say, that destruction is not good, however, this has been the only language that government has seem to understood from community members. But we always say that the state has a responsibility to really look after their communities way before even protests happen. If communities email a municipal manager and they say, hey, we have an issue, it's the state's responsibility to respond immediately or have communications, open communication lines to respond to those issues immediately before they get out of hand.
And why do you think the state fails in that response?
I really do think it's institutionalized corruption. It's a lack of accountability coming from the state. And it's also a lack of foresight. I'm seeing that dialogue is important to the growth of communities. It's important even to the growth of opportunities within that communities. And rather seeing dissent as an opportunity to improve, an opportunity to be held accountable, government always sees it as an attack on their leadership and their egos. So it's really more than anything, it's just a lack of foresight and not wanting to be held accountable by their citizens and people who vote them into power.
And what is particularly disturbing about this trend is that community frustration and protest is one thing, but often that gives way to criminal opportunism.
Most definitely. We've seen that some of you in any situation where there's chaos, there are those who want to take advantage of the situation. And we've seen that during the July unrest, when there were really genuine outcries around poverty, unemployment, especially during COVID, and how that July unrest was really captured by political, you know, people who really wanted to take advantage of the situation and bring in criminality into genuine struggles. And that sometimes does delegitimize, you know, protest action coming from communities. But organizations like ourselves are working really hard to ensure that that sort of criminality doesn't happen, but that communities can also spot it and report it immediately, and to differentiate themselves between those that are doing acts of criminality and protesters who are really protesting for genuine issues.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Omhle Ntshengila, Engagement Officer at the NGO Right to Protest.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, a cyber attack that destroyed, not stole, millions in Bitcoin has sent shockwaves through the crypto and cybersecurity worlds. And I want to explore this in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Vihan Olufia, FinTech and Digital Assets Lead at Forvis Mazars, to explain how hackers used blockchain to make itself, or to make a chilling and, I think, irreversible statement. And perhaps more importantly, let's talk a little bit about the risk and what this means for South African businesses. So, Vihan, a very warm welcome. Nice to have you on the show again. Let's start with that headline. Why would hackers destroy millions in Bitcoin instead of either spending it or even laundering it?
Yeah, Jeremy, thanks so much for having me on today again. So what we could see in terms of how this was approached and effectively what happened at the end of the day, it's the first time in history that we see this type of approach with a cyber attack as well. And you can see based on the fact that the funds are not being laundered or taken through mixers or whatever the case may be. It's not being utilized for anything. It is there to make a statement. And I believe it would be in relation to making a political statement in terms of the friction between Iran and Israel. And I mean, it's almost like we see a new chapter in cyber warfare. The cryptocurrency has been moved into a blockchain address. It's there for the whole world to see. And they left a quite prominent message in the address as well, where they stored all the funds, or they exiled the funds rather, on the blockchain.
Do we know technically how this was pulled off? How does one actually burn crypto and make it unrecoverable?
Yeah, so I think first of all, foremost, it was important just to know that the exchange itself that was hacked, that NoBitex that was hacked from a Iran perspective, also being the largest cryptocurrency exchange in Iran. So effectively what they did is they target the hot wallets of that specific cryptocurrency exchange. That means the wallets that are linked to the internet and not cold wallets that's disconnected from the internet. But effectively what the malicious actor effectively did is they created a on-chain address. And what was interesting enough is from a technical perspective, usually when you create an address, or also referred to as a wallet, that address or wallet is created from the private key that's hashed using a SHA-256 algorithm. It's hashed in to form the public key and then hashed again, of course, to form the wallet at the end of the day. But the makeup of the wallet where the funds were deposited in was so unique that it is impossible that based on today's computing power that address was actually created from a private key. So effectively saying that most probably there isn't even a private key. A private key doesn't exist. So if a private key doesn't exist, then effectively no one can gain access to that wallet or the funds situated in that wallet. And that's effectively how that malicious actor utilized blockchain technology to dump those cryptocurrency into that address to basically exile it on the blockchain.
So just help me understand this. Is the vulnerability then the blockchain itself or the exchange?
So the vulnerability itself in terms of where the funds were compromised was on the cryptocurrency exchange itself. The blockchain, the Bitcoin blockchain, the Ethereum blockchain, Ether, Ripple, Solana, the likes that have been used, worked exactly as intended, meaning if there's not a private key associated with the public key, associated with the address, then those funds won't be accessed at all. So the blockchain itself worked exactly as how they were designed to work.
Which, of course, raises the question then, how worried should South African exchanges and fintech firms be about a copycat?
Yeah, look, I think from that perspective, I've always thought about it, even with the Bybit hack that happened a couple of months ago as well. I think any type of cryptocurrency exchange or virtual asset service provider in South Africa, or any type of business that applies self-custody, needs to be wary of the associated risk that this could possibly happen to them as well. Not necessarily from a political standpoint, but from malicious actors in general. So, I mean, they need to apply certain, if I can call it, processes and protocols in place to make sure that as little as possible of the cryptocurrency is exposed to hot wallets that effectively malicious actors can hack. But I mean, it's also interesting from a South African point of view. If you think about with what happened with NoBitex, they were actually insured. So there was assurance payout of a portion of the funds. And then, of course, they refunded the customers in relation to internal funds. And exactly the same happened with Bybit as well. They had sufficient cash to be able to make those customers whole. But if that would happen in South African perspective, there's no insurance currently being offered to crypto asset service providers in South Africa. So it almost alludes to the fact that virtual asset service providers in South Africa needs to be more wary of this and make sure that they have the correct controls in place to make sure that they mitigate these types of risks.
And those processes or controls or protocols that you talk about, very briefly, what are they and would they be very difficult to implement?
Yeah, it's not too difficult to implement. I mean, most virtual asset service providers in South Africa already do implement a lot of that as well. So, of course, from an access control perspective as well, they need to make sure that the access is limited from a cybersecurity point of view and also performing things like penetration testing. But I think more prominent to that is as well to have a process in place where a significant portion of your custody holding or customer funds are kept in cold storage, meaning that's not connected to the internet and you only keep the necessary float in hot wallets. So if a breach had to occur and something had to be compromised, that at least it's not 100% of your fund that's being compromised. Mm. It may be only a 10 to 15% that's being compromised.
And obviously incumbent upon boards and executives who are dealing in this kind of platform, they would need to start tightening their crypto governance and response frameworks, particularly the governance.
Yeah, I think they're fully aware and appreciate the fact of the risks associated with self-custody, of course, just as much as they would know what the risk is if they were using a dedicated custodian from a counterparty risk perspective. But also, interestingly enough, when the intergovernmental fintech working group prescribed certain procedures or considerations for listed exchanges such as Johannesburg Stock Exchange, one of the areas that they specifically said to the stock exchange they need to look at in terms of if they were to list some type of Bitcoin spot ETF that applies self-custody, is that custody element and how they go about custodying the digital assets as well, and whether they use a custodian and whether that custodian is up to scratch and up to par in terms of these protocols and controls.
I'll just need a quick answer to this. Does this incident then prove Bitcoin's strength, its fragility, or both?
I think probably more its strength, to a certain extent, that those cryptocurrency situated in that address is there forever and it can't ever be touched. So I think it just reiterates the fact that it is so secure that you can't access the funds once a private key is lost or even securely held somewhere else.
Vihan Olufia, thank you very much indeed. FinTech and Digital Assets Lead at Forvis Mazars. I appreciate your time. And that's where we're going to leave it for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.